Being Captain Eccles, River 6. We were just talking about your time with number 1407 meteorological flight based at Reykjavik, Iceland.
Yeah.
I know you wanted to say something about the status of the flight.
Yeah. Being posted to Foreman Command 1407 Met flight at the age of 22, in hindsight, was the beginning of quite an interesting career in the Royal Air Force, because I was, for the first time, a commanding officer, and actually, apart from the Met office, no one was very interested in the day-to-day activities of the Met flight, so I was very much on my own as to what I did. This is why I was able to state the requirements for the operational requirements for the modifications to the aircraft, and for eventually turning up in Iceland and carrying out the first Met flight in April, some months after the thing was supposed to be going. And after that Met flight, I went on to command other units in the same way, and for the most of the war, I had an existence where I could do almost what I wanted. During the time that I was commanding the Met flight at Reykjavik, we, like the other units that were then based at Reykjavik, had to take it in turns to be what was called duty flight. The responsibility of the duty flight was to refuel and service any visiting aircraft. And on one occasion, we found ourselves involved in having to refuel and service a large four-engined Russian bomber, which was an Antonov, a very unusual high-wing monoplane. And it turned out, in fact, it was on a rather hush-hush flight taking Molotov for a conference in America. I took the opportunity, whilst we were servicing the aircraft, of going into the cockpit and having a good look at it, and was very interested to see that the instrument panel was very similar to that of a Hudson. In fact, the instruments looked to me as if they were Sperry instruments, or if they weren't Sperry, at least they were Chinese copies of them. Rather surprised me to see how very similar the cockpit layout was to that of an RAF aircraft.
Anything else about your time with 1407?
No, everything again was routine, and my memory of detail of that is insufficient to make any further comment.
Did you have any casualties amongst your flight on these things? It's pretty dangerous from the sound of it.
Strangely enough, whilst I was commanding, I don't think we had any, but after I left, the flight ran into all kinds of troubles and had a lot of casualties.
So just a matter of luck?
Yes, and also, whilst Coastal Command was the Cinderella of the Royal Air Force, Met flights were the Cinderella of Coastal Command. And later on, the Hudson aircraft were wanted for the operational squadrons and were taken away from the Met flights, who were given a variety of aircraft to try out and finished up with some very worn out and elderly Hampden aircraft. And some of these caused casualties because of their general condition.
So how did you come to leave? Was it you left in...
I left Iceland. I left the Met flight in Iceland after completing the tour of duty. In fact, a rather extended tour of duty, because the tour of duty was in Iceland was a year, and I was out there for over a year. And then I returned to the UK and went to the an instructor at the operational training unit that had been set up at RAF Thornaby, the Coastal Command training unit.
So this is number 6 Coastal
OTU,
operational training unit at Thornaby.
Yeah, that's right.
And you were an instructor?
I was an instructor there for a short time, and then the flight commander of 1404 Met flight at St. Evel had been posted on, and there was a vacancy, and I was immediately put in to take over the Met flight at Sir Neville.
Now, anything about, you know, before we go on to that, about your time as an instructor?
I was only at Sir Neville for a very brief time. The only memory I have is taking part in an air sea rescue mission where two bomber commands, Blenheim squadrons, had been carrying out an attack off the Norwegian coast and had come into a lot of opposition from enemy fighters, and most of the squadrons were shot down, and we were sent out to see if we could find any survivors in the sea. Didn't see any.
How did you find instructing? I mean, what were you actually teaching, flying or...?
It was teaching, it was the same course as at Silloth, converting people to fly Hudson aircraft. Actually, I never did any instruction. I was only being, in the early stages of being instructed myself on how to be an instructor when I got posted.
How were you taking to being taught to be an instructor? I mean, was it something you wanted to do?
No, I didn't have any particular bent for being instructor, and I was only too happy to be moved on to back to operational flying.
Now, that was in October, 1st of October 42, to number 1404 meteorological.
Yeah, right? That's right.
And that was at St.
St. Evil.
Evil, where's that? Sorry,
Cornwall, yeah. Near Newquay.
And what was the setup there?
Well, St. Evil was a very busy coastal command station. The mess had been it was a wooden mess, and it was quite incapable of taking the large number of personnel that was required because of a lot of squadrons there, including American squadrons. And so each major hotel in the area became the mess for a squadron. The Met flight, of course, wasn't large enough to have such a thing, and I was billeted out with a dear old lady in Newquay.
What were the billets like?
Oh, it was very pleasant. It was she was an elderly widow, and it was a bungalow, and I had my own room, and she provided me with breakfast. Apart from that, my time was spent elsewhere.
What aircraft did they still have Hudsons here,
we started off with Hudsons. And then, as I say, they were taken away from us. So then came a question of offering us a replacement. And the first replacement they sent was a Ventura, which was, in fact, a rather updated form of a Hudson. And I was delighted with it and said straight away, yes, this is what we wanted. But regrettably, Bomber Command decided they wanted Venturas for number two group, and so we didn't get them. Then they sent me an Albemarle.
Albemarle?
Albemarle, which was the first tricycle undercarriage aircraft in the Royal... British-made tricycle undercarriage aircraft in the Royal Air Force. And it was mostly of a wooden structure and totally incapable of doing the Met flight job because it had it couldn't get much above about 15,000 or 16,000 feet. So we turned that down with no problem at all. And then, as a result, we got the Hamdens. And the first Hamden that came along was, in fact, a mixture of a Hamden and a Hereford. It had been discarded, I think, by Bomber Command OTU, which was no longer flying or operating Hamdens. And the inside of the aircraft was interesting. The forward part was silver inside, and the rear part was green. Because, in fact, it was a marriage of a Hereford, which was a Canadian-built Hamden with Napier Dagger engines, and a Hamden. And it was not a particularly reliable aeroplane. We discovered that on one occasion I got into an incipient yaw, which was extremely tricky, and I had to use full throttle on the inboard engine and throttle back the outboard to get the aircraft straight again. And afterwards we discovered that the four bolts holding the tailplane were all loose. But the incipient yaw was, in fact, a feature of the Hamden. During this time at the Met flight, when I first arrived, I got involved in Operation Torch. We were required to carry out special Met flights in the Torch area to provide vital weather information as to whether the final operation should go ahead or not. That was one activity. Another was that as a follow-up from Torch, we had to send a detachment down to Gibraltar to carry out Met flights down there. The
when you flew the flight, I mean, would you go down to Gibraltar anyway to do it? Or
no, no, we had to send an aircraft and crew down there on detachment to carry out these flights. We had a number of casualties of one sort and another. On one occasion, we lost an aircraft. He was out over the Bay of Biscay in the dark and sent a message that there was a flare on the water he was investigating. He never returned. I decided that possibly the flare was a decoy that the Germans had put out and that they waited for the moths to come around the candle. So I issued an instruction to my crews that if they saw a flare on the water, that they were to report it, but not to investigate it. On another occasion, I lost a crew who failed to return, and later we heard they were prisoners of war. After the war, in an interesting program of Esther Ranson's, there was a complete story about what happened to this crew. They had, in fact, like so many Met flights, found themselves considerably off course and were over the French coast and were shot down and crash landed on the beach, and the aircraft caught fire. On the beach were some German and some French people, some German soldiers and French people. Two of the crew got out all right. The third member of the crew was trying to get the pilot out who was caught up, and he was assisted greatly by a Frenchman until the Germans came along and stopped him. However, by this time the pilot was taken out, but he was fairly badly burnt, and the two of the crew were fairly badly injured. But they survived. The pilot died. The rest of the crew survived the war. The next thing that happened was that I finished my tour, my operational tour of flying, and went back to Thornaby.
Now, can you tell us perhaps what a typical flight in a Hampton would be like? When you used to still take flights out yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, well, a Hampton aircraft, in terms of the cockpit, was very much like a single-seat aircraft. You were on your own in a cockpit, and there was no ability to reach any of the other members of the crew. The bomb aimer was in his own compartment underneath you, and the wireless operator, air gunner, was in his compartment behind you. It was a fairly narrow-bodied aircraft. And the chief thing I remember on the Met flights was it was extremely cold, and we eventually were able to persuade the powers that be to supply us with electrically heated flying clothing.
Because the Hudsons had their own heating, hadn't
they? Yes, yes, yes. But these aircraft had no heating, and they were very cold. But we got this electrically heated clothing, which did help.
What was it like?
Well, it was still not all that good. The gloves were electrically heated as well, but they were, as a result of the heating elements, they were rather sort of restricted your movements with what you could do with your fingers. Also was the fact that on an extended flight, we had to have some form of relieving ourselves. And I took this matter up, and we were sent a piece of equipment which we were told was used by members of parliament when they were in long debates, which consisted of a rubber device that fitted over the penis and a long tube that went down inside your leg. Unfortunately, there was nowhere for the tube at the end to go. And on the one occasion that I was compelled to use this, there was no option but for the effluent to go out over the cockpit floor. And, of course, the navigator was underneath me, who was complaining about the rain coming in. I didn't put him wise.
And what about the equipment? I mean, how did you check? I mean, you would still radio wireless back with all the details.
Yes.
How did they collect the details? The equipment would be on the outside of the aircraft. But
well, in the early days of the Met flights, the navigator was expected to do all the observations, and these observations were they were all observations of figures, of temperatures and pressures, and they were then.
Where would he have his machines? I mean, would they?
He didn't have any. Well, the strut psychrometer was outside the navigation station, so he could read through. There was a little window, and he could read the temperatures through it. All the figures that he then had to be coded through a one-time pad into groups of five figures, and these five-figure groups were then sent off by the wireless operator to base. And of course, they were long messages, there were a large number of groups, and it was quite a task for the wireless operator to clear these messages. Also, of course, as far as we were concerned, it was giving away a certain amount of tactical information to the enemy.
And,
operations from St. Evel were somewhat different from those in Iceland, because we were very much closer to the to Germany and France and to enemy aircraft and to the effects of enemy aircraft on our operations in the Bay of Biscay.
Did you ever encounter any enemy aircraft yourself?
Fortunately, no.
And what about submarines? I mean, you know, were you still on the lookout for them as you had Hampton?
Yeah, we always, of course, carried depth charges. I can't remember whether we did in Hampton's or not. I'm afraid my memory isn't good enough there. But I do know that at the time we took over command of the Met flight at St. Evel, it actually had more U-boat attacks to its merit than the Hudson squadron that was based there.
Simply because of where its longest flight?
Well, no, because they just happened to. It was. Looking for U-boats was a needle in a haystack, and sometimes you found them, sometimes you didn't. It was pure luck. There was, incidentally, when we were being briefed in the operations room, on the wall chart in the operations room was quite often a mark called a U-boat guess of a position of a U-boat. It was, of course, only years afterwards that I realised that this wasn't so much a guess, but the fact that it was information obtained by having broken the German code, and was therefore much more reliable than we ever thought. Activities in the Bay of Biscay were U-boat activities were at a very high level, because all U-boats were having to transit the bay from the French bases to operations in the Atlantic, and the situation in 1942 was extremely difficult, because the German U-boats were now operating in wolf packs on the surface and fighting it out, shooting at the aircraft. And aircraft casualties attacking U-boats were pretty high. There was an occasion of a Coastal Command captain being awarded a decoration on the evidence given by the U-boat commander, because as the aircraft came in, it was hit and set on fire, it carried out the attack and went straight into the sea the other side, and all the crew perished. By March of 43, the U-boat war had changed completely. The Allies had totally dominated the U-boat situation, and from then on, the U-boats were no longer the hunters, they were the hunted.
Now, anything else about your time at 1404, sorry, flight?
There was one amusing incident, an anecdote. one of the young airmen on the flight was responsible for towing the tractor, for operating the tractor to tow the Bowser around and to tow aircraft around. This was a Caterpillar tractor. And the hangar we were using, the one end of it had been bombed and was rather damaged. On one occasion, I was in the hangar with the engineer officer looking at one of our aircraft up on trestles, when through the sidewall of the hangar came the Caterpillar tractor trundling along. And it was heading straight for our aircraft on trestles. There was no one on it. But round the corner, running at high speed, was this young lad who jumped onto the tractor and drove it away just in time. Needless to say, he was on a charge. And when I investigated the charge the following morning, he knew, of course, he was on a charge. As I went into my office, there was a large basket of a couple of dozen fresh eggs. Needless to say, his father was a local farmer, and eggs were rationed. However, when I investigated the case, I discovered that this young lad, and he was only about 18 or so, the tractor was a bit decrepit, and the ignition switch didn't work. And the only way he could stop the engine was by shorting the wire against part of the chassis. It had become his custom when parking the tractor outside the hangar to push it up against the wall and stall the engine. On this particular occasion, it didn't stall the engine. The wall collapsed and the tractor went through and he jumped off. So I let him off the charge.
But that's about it for your time with them.
Yeah.
And before we go on, this is just going back to when you were at Iceland.
Yes.
This is this chap, the artist, Revilius. I'm not sure of his first name. But if you'd like to tell us of your contact with him, which is not direct, but is of some interest.
Yes, after the war, my daughter was reading a book and asked me, where was I based at Caledonis? And I said, I was. She said, well, it's interesting because the book I'm reading is about Eric Revilius, who was lost by not coming back from a mission at Caledonis. This interested me because it was the first I'd heard about it, but it certainly was at the time that 269 Squadron at Caledonis, although it was after I'd left. So we carried out an investigation through the historical branch and others, and eventually were able to say, yes, it was on a 269 aircraft that Revilius was lost. The story, in fact, was really rather a tragedy. Revilius was a well-known artist before the war and became an official war artist and had the honorary rank of captain in the Royal Marines. He just arrived in Iceland and checked in at headquarters and next day or so went to Caledonis. He arrived at Caledonis on the 1st of September 1942. And on that day, one of our aircraft had failed to return. So the following day, three aircraft were sent out to search for the missing aircraft. And it turned out that Revilius went as a passenger in one of those aircraft, captained by a flight lieutenant, Ginger Culver. Sadly, that aircraft also failed to return. And so Revilius was lost. Owing to operational reasons and administrative shortcomings, it wasn't recognised at the time that Revilius was on board this aircraft. It only turned out afterwards, when we investigated the station records and the sick quarter records, that we were able to put the pieces together and satisfy ourselves that, in fact, he was on that aircraft, and that's how he came to be lost.
Now, going back into your main story, in April, between April and May of 43, you nipped back to, and nipped probably the word, to number 6 Coastal Command Operational Training Unit at Thornaby, where you were a flying instructor on Hudson aircraft, it says. Anything to say about this? Or?
Yes, I was back again, facing up to the idea of being an instructor, which didn't exactly appeal to me. And I hadn't been at the unit for very long when, at one lunchtime, sitting in the mess, and I heard somebody behind me say that he'd just been posted to South Africa to the General Reconnaissance School, and he was getting married next week, and this was a bit of a blow. And I turned round and said, well, I'd be very happy to take your place. So I did, and in no time at all, I was off to South Africa.
And this didn't worry you at all? You know, it's what you wanted?
Absolutely.
And this was to the number one school of GR, General Reconnaissance?
Yes. This was the school that I'd originally been at in Guernsey and Houghton Park, and it had gone out to George in South Africa. And so I was going out to be an instructor at the School of General Reconnaissance.
And what do you remember of the trip out? Because it's quite a journey out. You didn't fly, I presume?
No, I went on a troop ship, and this was quite interesting in two ways. First of all, the ship itself. It was an American ship, the Argentina, which had been a pre-war cruising ship from New York through the Panama Canal to the west. A luxury liner, but by no means a luxury liner as a troop ship. It had been converted to carry troops across the Atlantic, and as a result, it was only capable of feeding us twice a day, which for a short trip across the Atlantic was quite acceptable. But for the 6 weeks or so that it took us to get to South Africa, it was a bit of a drawback. However, this was offset by the fact that amongst the many thousands of passengers on this ship were a number of army nursing sisters. And I was able to fill in the time between breakfast and an evening meal in a most agreeable fashion. In fact, so much so that we arrived in Durban and disembarked on the Monday, and we got married in Durban on the Thursday. And the Catholic priest who married us, I am still in touch with on emails, and in fact, as a retired archbishop, I had the honour of giving him lunch in my cottage a month ago.